Okay, we'll get started. I want to thank Rabbi Strochler for over the years and today all his help, and it's a pleasure working with him on many of the programs we do, and just want to wish him continued hatzlacha in the community, and it's an honor to have him speak. The rabbi of the shul, of course, to give our next talk. Rabbi Strochler.
See, Jay knows how to sell a source sheet. This man knows what he's doing. Get them while they're hot. So I'm going to begin with a story that you've never heard before, because I've never told it before, because it just happens. I was davening a mincha here, and a colleague came over to me and said, "Happy Tisha B'Av." So I said, "Okay, happy Tisha B'Av." And then he said to me, "You know, I see that you look pretty sad. I have some good news to share with you. I just got engaged." I said, "Well, mazel tov, very nice." So I said, you still look sad. He said, "That's because I want to be sad. It's Tisha B'Av, I should be sad." And it's an interesting thing that we do this time of year. We're really good at doing all sorts of activities, like not shaving. Things like, you know, wearing clothes that have not been washed for many days. That sort of thing we're really good at. But if you look at what we're really asked to do during this time period, it's not simply to go through the motions. But really, it's Mishunichnas Av Mimatim Besimcha. This is season source number one. When the month of Av comes in, we decrease our joy. But yet, if you go around and you ask someone, "How are you doing this week?" they'll give you the exact same answer they give you the rest of the year, the other 51 weeks of the year, which is, "I'm fine," or "Great," or "Good." Baruch Hashem. Have you ever heard a person come over to you and say, ask you during the 9 days, "How you doing?" "I'm sad for the destruction of the temple. I've been around for a little while. It's never happened to me once. Not once." My question to you is why? Why is it that we're so good at going through the motions, but when it comes to the culture, the system in which we live, we really haven't got at the goal? The goal is to be sad today. The goal is to be sad. And yet, we're very good at fasting. We're very good at wearing not leather shoes. But yet, if you really ask yourself deeply right now, are you sad? What are you going to answer? What are you going to answer? So I want to look today at this question of sadness and the religious value within it as both intendant upon this holiday of Tisha B'Av, and also more broadly as well. So let's look at our second source, which is an explanation on our first source. What does it mean, ma'atin b'simcha? What does it mean that you should decrease your joy? Perush, she'ein smechin klal. K'mo shekasav b'Tosafot perek kama de Megillah. Meaning that you should not be happy at all. She'ein smechin klal. You should do nothing that's going to bring you joy during the course of those 9 days, during the course of the month of Av. So that is Tisha B'Av related. But then, beyond Tisha B'Av has a glow that extends beyond just Tisha B'Av, which is something that I will be teaching this evening, most likely between Mincha and Maariv here in the Shul, which is Siman Tav Kuf Samach. And this is the laws of remembering the temple year-round. Now, if I ask you around the room here, when do the people in this room remember the temple outside of Tisha B'Av? What answers would you give me? This is not a hard one, folks. Everyone knows what happens at a Jewish wedding. What do we do at a Jewish wedding? We break a glass. That's right. It comes from this siman over here. You break a glass. Why do you break a glass? To remember the temple. That's what everyone says, right? Today you're going to learn that that is not true. It's a good thing you came today. to learn something new. So we have to learn through the Siman. We have to explore the sources and see what exactly Shulchan Aruch says, because I just said that it is contained within the Siman that we break cups, which is true, but we're going to see the reason is not so clear. So let's begin. We're going to learn a Siman of Shulchan Aruch. Source number 3. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash. When the temple was destroyed, Tiknu Chachamim Shehayu Ba'oso Hador, She'ein Bonim Le'olam Binyan Misuyad U'mechuyar Kibinyan HaMlachim. When the temple was destroyed, the sages decreed that no one would be allowed to build a finished home like kings build unless one left over an area one by one cubit by the opening that is unfinished without mortar or plaster. So as we describe here, Elatach, Beveto, Betit, Desad, Besid, Mishayer, Makom, Amma, Al Amma, Kenegat, Patach, Belosid. So a person is to leave over a part of their home which is unfinished as a remembrance of Jerusalem. And you see this sometimes in Israel among people who build houses who know halacha. And you'll find when you first walk into the door, you'll see a little a nook or almost like a little painting almost. But what it is an unfinished wall. You see a little bit of stone in there, you know, a little bit of grout, and you see it there on the wall. Every now and then you see this in Chutz La'aretz also, but it's a bit rare. And that's because of the next point. But although keach chatzim isuyad mechuyar, harezu becheskas, cheskas of emech ayavim osola klof bekostlim. If you buy a house, and the house is fully finished, because the contractor who built it didn't know that you were going to have learned this piece of Shulchan Aruch before buying the house, and he finished the entire house, and you walk in, and look, oh, the thing's finished. Do you have to go and scrape out the house so that it looks unfinished? No, that you don't have to do. So that's why all our houses are nice, well-finished, and so on. If you're building a house from scratch, you should leave part of it undone. Why? Because the Chachamim said after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we shouldn't have things which are so nice. We should hold back just a little bit. And you should know it's not just in building houses. Next Sif. If a person is going to be setting a table to invite guests, what should you do? You should leave over something from that which you are making for your beautiful meal. And leave a little spot which is imperfect, so that one of the places that belongs in a certain location is not where it's supposed to be. And when a woman is placing cosmetic painting of gold and silver, she should leave over one of the jewelry or the cosmetics that she would normally place, in order that the jewelry should not be complete. We leave over just a little bit of the jewelry. It shouldn't be perfect. And when a groom marries a bride, he should take ash from a fireplace and place it on the head in this place where he wears his tefillin. So that's a custom that people are starting to do a little bit more frequently. Recently at a wedding where the rabbi put it on in front of everybody right under the chuppah. Personally, I like to do it in private beforehand, but this is something that people do. Again, to remember Jerusalem, I do this too. I ask the chassan, do you want me to put a little bit of ash on your forehead? I promise you it will not show up in any of the pictures. But we do this. And now, what everyone's been waiting for, the Ramah says, V'yesh mekamot, there are those places, shenagu l'shaber kos b'sha'as chupa, where they have the custom to break a cup at a wedding. Or they place a black cloth or something other sign of a velos upon the head of the chassan. The chassan's one is always getting it on the head, you know? Nothing about the kala. It's always the chassan who's getting it. V'chol eila hadvarim k'dei l'schores Yerushalayim sh'nemar im eshkachech Yerushalayim tishkach yimimi im lo alet Yerushalayim arosh simchasi. So, as the song we sing when we break the cup under the chuppah, this is the source of these halachos. All these things are done in order to remember Jerusalem. And this is true 24/7, 354 days a year. We remember Jerusalem in these ways. So I just said that we break a cup not for this reason. And yet here it seems pretty clear from the Ramban, from the way the Shulchan Aruch presents things, that the reason that we're breaking a cup is what? To remember Jerusalem. Okay, so you got to keep that in the back of your head, this seeming question on my position. Let's continue on as we go through our sources, looking at now Si'if Gimel. V'chein Gazru, the rabbis had other things to do. Shelo v'nagein b'chlei shir, v'chol minei zemer, v'chol mashmi kol shel shir l'sameach b'hem. They also made an enactment that it's not appropriate to play music. Hagam. V'yesh omim davchim yishiragil b'hem, k'gon ha'malachim sh'omdim v'shokvim b'chlei shir, v'beis ha'mishta. So he says, the Ramah here comments, others say that this only applies to those who are accustomed to them, being played constantly, like kings who get up and lie down with musical instruments. And it also applies during a meal. But if you're going to have music which you're playing for knowledge, if you're doing it even for enjoyment, but it's not constant, the Ramah thinks it might be permissible. So here we have the Shulchan Aruch saying, we have no business listening to music anymore. No music. And then the Ramah says, okay, music is allowed. It's only for people who are going to be listening to it constantly. That's what's not allowed because of the destruction of the temple. Even drinking songs where it's only by voice and there's no music being played on an instrument, that also is asura. Shneimar b'shir lo yishtu yayin. L'kvar nagu kol yisro lomar divrei tishpachot shir shal hodot v'zichron chasidei kadosh baruch hu al hayayin. But everyone knows that when it comes to singing songs around the Shabbos table, or singing songs of praise to God, that we do use music for. V'chein l'tzorach mitzvah, says the Ramam, you can also do it for mitzvah as well. So k'gon, rebeis chas, makala, kol shari. So at the wedding halls, you can play as much music as you like. That's appropriate. But with all the caveats and limitations, it seems that we should not be enjoying music the way we would have before the temple was destroyed. That as a remembrance of the temple, we should somehow mediate the amount of music that we listen to. Okay. Sif Dalet. Hope no one's leaving here because of all these halachos. Everyone's staying here? Okay, good. Chen Gazra ala taros chasanim. The also the key that grooms may not wear any type of crown or wreath on their heads. As it says, the mitznefes is missing and the crown is gone. Anyone complaining about this one? This one I think we were okay with. You know, we're not used to chasanim wearing crowns. But it seems to be in the custom back in the day that grooms used to wear crowns and wreaths on their heads when they went to the wedding. And this is not done anymore. V'chein gazru al taros hakala, imhi shal kasef, aval shal gedil mutar lakala, v'dafka l'chatam hakala, aval b'shar kol nashim v'nashim lo gazru. And for the kala also, she cannot wear things made out of silver. She can wear other things, other types of crowns, but not silver crowns. And this agree only applies to the bride and the groom, but for other people, they can wear these things. Now finally, the last of the halachot in the siman, we say, it is forbidden for a man to excessively fill his mouth with laughter in this world. So here you have it. After the destruction of the temple, we are meant to be dour, sour people who live life with sadness. That's what's expected of us. We are not supposed to excessively fill our mouths with laughter. We should never have a good time. Because the temple was destroyed. How can we have a good time if the temple was destroyed? Now, this would be the position that you would conclude having read through the Shulchan Aruch straight. But what you don't realize here is the Shulchan Aruch is actually mixing and matching. A whole series of halachot have been brought together and joined together in a way that really does not accord with the sources of these halachos. So let's try to pull it apart a little bit and try to understand how these things work. Look at source number 4, Talmud Masechet Brachot. We're going to look at it in two different sessions. It's actually a continuous quote, but I decided to translate it in between to make it easier to read. Mai v'gilu b'ra'ada. The section here is dealing with how a person begins to pray. And we're told that a person should pray not out of a celebration, a person shouldn't be to be laughing, a person should approach their prayer seriously. So we ask, Mai v'gilu b'rada, what does this pasuk mean that a person should rejoice with trembling? It's a funny thing, how do you rejoice and tremble at the same time? It's in contradictory emotions. Amar Rav Ada Bar Masna, Amar Rabba, B'makom Gila, Sham Tehera Adam. Rav Ada Bar Masna says, in the place where there is rejoicing, there should also be trembling. So wherever you rejoice, you should also hold back just a little bit and have an element of trembling as well. Abaye have a Yosef Kamei de Rabba. Abaye was sitting before his teacher, Rabba. Chazia dehava kabad chachtuva. You see, the people were smiling a lot. They were as if they'd be making merry. So what do you do? Amar Leia, Ana, Amar Vigi. Excuse me. Have a kav madach tuva. Amar Vigilu Baradaksiv. It says, rejoice with trembling. So the response then was, he replied, I am putting on tefillin. So he admonished him, and the response to reflect the seriousness of the moment was that he's now going to place his tefillin. That would then counteract this feeling of excessive merriment. Similar story again. Rabbi Yirmi was sitting before Rabbi Zera, who saw that he seemed very merry. He said to him, it is written, in all sorrow there is profit. He replied, I'm wearing tefillin. So what's the different pasuk from Mishlei? Behold, atzev yem mosar. There is profit in sorrow. Next story. Mar, the son of Ravina, made a marriage feast for his son. Now let's just read that again in the text itself. Mar Ravina hava hilula labare. Chazanu l'rabbanu dehavu kabad chituva. He saw that the rabbis were making a big party. Aisui kasa demokra. He brought a fancy cup. Bas arba meazuzi. Worth 400 zuz. V'tavar kamayhu. And he broke it before everyone. Va'itzvu. And suddenly everyone became sad because the cup had been broken. Everyone became serious. Look at the waste of money. 400 zuz down the drain. A cup is broken. Terrible. And likewise, Rabbi Ashi made a feast for his son. So the rabbis were growing very merry. So he broke a cup of white crystal and broke it before them. And they became serious. Rabbi said to Rabbi Abnuna Zuti at the wedding of Mar, the son of Ravina, pleasing us something. He said to them, alas for us that we are to die. A nice song for a wedding, right? They said to him, what shall we respond to you? Everyone knows this song requires back and forth. What are we supposed to sing? He said to them, where is the Torah and where is the mitzvah that will shield us? So the response is that the Torah will protect us from this worldly death and thereby allow us to enter the world to come. So let me ask you, from what I've just read to you, the stories that we just read, has there been any mention of the temple throughout this entire section? And he mentioned the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. This, according to Tosfos, and according to everyone basically, is a source for breaking a cup under a chuppah. It's this Talmud in Isachas Brachos. People are partying too much. We break a cup. Break a cup. And when people see the cup is broken, what are they supposed to do? They say, get a little more serious. Now, of course, the irony is, what happens when you break a cup under the chuppah? What does everyone say? Mazel tov! No, that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to say, Oy gewalt! I hope it wasn't my cup. I hope it wasn't such a nice cup. See, maybe it's because we use light bulbs now. That's why everyone gets upset. Or because we sort of lost the point. We've lost the message. And the message is really not a message of remembering Jerusalem. From this piece in Talmud, what would the message then be? What is the problem with celebrating too much at a wedding or laughing when you're in class? What's the problem? The problem is that Jews are supposed to be serious people because life is a serious thing. People shouldn't be making too much fun. People shouldn't be laughing too much. People shouldn't be partying too much. We have to know that we live in a world where things matter. And as a result, we don't want to laugh too much. We want to make light. We have to treat our world as being a place where God is present and God asks things of us. God, in His message to us through Chazal, through Koheles, through Mishlei, through Tehillim, through all these places, tells us that we are to take life seriously. And if we are too excessive in our joy and rejoicing, what does that mean? that we are in some respects denying God or denying our connection to God in some small way. So this just raises a problem for us. Why is it then that the Shulchan Aruch groups it all together? Why is it that the Ramah quotes the practice of breaking cups under the chuppah in regards to Tisha B'Av or in regards to the temple, when really what it's about is about not being too joyous generally? So you can look at source number 5, which is the continuation of that piece of the Talmud, where the actual formulation is the same formulation as we find in the Talmud, which is Amar B'Yochanan Mishim Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai, Asur L'Adam Shimali P'Tzchok Piv B'Olam Hazeh. It's forbidden for a man to fill his mouth with laughter in this world, because it says, then will our mouths be filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. When will that be? At the time when they shall say among the nations, the Lord hath done great things with these. It was related to Reish Lakish that he never again filled his mouth with laughter in this world, as you're the saying from Yochanan, his teacher. So in this quote, you could explain that it's not something inherent about joy itself, which is a problem, but rather it is the fact that the nations of the world have not yet come to recognize God's full presence. So that in the time of the coming of Mashiach, when everything is wonderful and things are perfect, then we're able to fill our mouths with joy fully. Then we can malei piv schok. Then we can be fully joyous. But until that point, not. So perhaps there is, within this section, perhaps the hint of where the Ramah goes, where the Ramah links the statement about general feelings of seriousness to the seriousness that comes from the absence of the temple. However, I don't think it's brought out from the text really, because what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is describing, and Rabbi Yochanan is describing, is the ultimate redemption. Something that even before the temple was built, or even before the temple was destroyed, had not yet been achieved. The prophecy of which he describes here, is referring to a time of ultimate redemption. And that point, of course, has not yet been reached. And there's a long legacy of this approach, of this seriousness that we take as Jews. Let's look at Kohelet source number 6. This should be familiar to many of us. Tov shem yishem en tov v'yom amavis niyom avil baldo. A good name is better than precious oil, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Tov lalechet al beis avel, milechet al beis mishtem, ba'ashir husov kol ha'adam, v'achayi tenet libo. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Vexation is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart may be gladdened. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. What Kohelet here is describing is an approach to life, which is that we see within sadness the possibility of gladness, that to approach life seriously, to not be overly frivolous, to seek out moments of sadness can be the basis by which the heart can gain wisdom. And I want to skip ahead now to the last page of our source sheet to see this idea brought forward by a number of smart people. We'll look at the first of those smart people. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. He writes, human happiness does not depend on comfort. The American Jew, those Americans, follows a philosophy which equates religion with making Jewish life more comfortable and convenient. It enables the Jew to have more pleasures in life. This de-emphasizes Judaism's spiritual values. So we've become, in our pursuit of religion, of the belief that religion is there to make us happy. That's our philosophy in so many ways. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that this desire for comfort and convenience is not the only path to the spiritual happiness that we seek. That very often, there are other ways to gain the spiritual values. And I think that one of those ways, one of those places by which we can come to this seriousness is through Tisha B'Av itself. Let's look at source number 11. The first of the sources, number 11, because I seem to have numbered two 11s. This is from Dr. Erica Brown's book, which she published last year, In the Narrow Places, Daily Inspiration for the 3 Weeks. We live in a period that is enormously invested in happiness. Just type books of unhappiness into Amazon and see what you come up with. By my count, it's close to 17,000. We guard our happiness closely and do not want to mar it with sad thoughts. We fail to view suffering as a natural part of human life, living in such relative comfort as we do. Suffering always takes us by surprise, as if it were an injustice. And as it is an injustice, we look for someone to blame. Sharon Salzberg, in her book, Loving Kindness, points out that we feel obliged to defend our happiness because it seems so fragile, unstable, as though our happiness needed constant protection. We deny the very possibility of suffering. We cut ourselves off from facing it in ourselves and in others because we fear that it will undermine or destroy our good fortune. Suffering humanizes us. If I was right, I would use the word however, but Brown did not use the word however. Suffering humanizes us. Ignoring suffering dehumanizes us. I don't want to ruin my good mood by looking at that homeless person, so I turn away. And with that turning, I let go of my social responsibility to him. Attunement to suffering makes us more compassionate. It also helps us appreciate where we come from and all that it took to get us to where we are. We have to remind ourselves that we don't diminish our happiness when we spend a day or a few weeks meditating on the tragedies of history from which we emerged. We become more grateful, holding on tightly to our blessed lives because we can. Or to quote from the source that we just saw in Kohelet, fixation is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart may be gladdened. So what Erica Brown encourages us to do is to live these periods of time, to live the 3 weeks, to live the 9 days, as an opportunity to engage in sadness, to engage in suffering, and by doing so, deepen our hearts, to open up pathways of the emotional universe that are also often closed off to us. Looking now at source number 12, this is written by a person who's not Jewish. This is an author of Matt de la Pena. It requires a little squeegee over the nun. I just didn't have it at the time on my computer. I'm sure it was there, I just couldn't find it. He writes this essay, or this short post, as part of a New York Times discussion on this topic, is fiction changing for better or worse? He writes, there are plenty of obvious reasons the mainstream novel occupies such a different place in the lives of today's readers. One of the most important factors, however, is less obvious. We've grown terrified of sadness and self-reflection, and we actively avoid ideas that challenge. If there's such a thing as emotional gravity, it's the invisible force that continually pulls humans back down to their natural resting state of melancholy. Life is sad, man. We understand so little about existence, except that we're ultimately alone, and eventually we're all going to die. It used to be okay to sit in this sadness. Great novels examined it. But today, in the era of pharmaceutical companies, the second we stop smiling, we rush off to the dock for a happy pill prescription. Some people genuinely need medication. Others are ducking perfectly healthy, even beneficial, bouts of melancholy. This shift has directly affected the kind of novels many of us read. We don't want our ideologies to be challenged. That's too much work. We want escape. We want affirmation. We want to be told that we really are good enough and smart enough. Sad and challenging novels are still being released, but fewer of us are investing our time in them. Kafka believed a book should wake us up with a blow to the head. We don't want our novels to do that anymore. If anything, we seek novels that will deepen our sleep. I wonder if you guys would check your summer reading list or the books you've taken up for your summer trips. How would you judge them? How would you judge your summer reading? Summer reading is about escape. Everyone knows what a summer reading book is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be Kafka. Kafka is not good summer reading. It just isn't. So I would like to argue that there's a value to sadness, and that the window that we have as Jews into this realm of sadness is something which is fixed within our calendars. That it's something which is there for our spiritual, our emotional health. That we are to engage in the sadness of Tisha B'Av, to remember these moments, not just to remember the temple, which is one good part of it, but also because there is inherent within the human psyche, a value to seriousness, a value to sadness. And therefore, the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch take sections of the Talmud that are universal, that are beyond the temple, and they filter them through the story of the temple's remembrance to convey an idea to us. That when do we as Jews experience this crucial human need for sadness? We experience it around the temple. But had the temple never been destroyed, the Kohelet would still have been there. Kohelet would still be true. Kohelet was written before the temple was ever destroyed. It was written by Solomon. It was still necessary. It's still important. So with that, I'm going to show you the source that says all of this, or says some of it, which is the Taz, source number 7. Schok be'olam hazeh, kach kasav b'shem Rabbeinu Yonah. This is what he writes in quoting from Rabbeinu Yonah. Dimashma gam shelo b'zman ha'galus. That we are not to have schok in this world, we're not to fill our mouths with this experience of joy or this great schok, laughter, even shalob zman galus, even when we're not in exile. Lokin tzachatur shekasav galus hazam. V'yir le'anias daiti, and it seems according to my humble opinion, sheyesh chilek v'zel de'inyan simcha she'eino shel mitzvah. Vaday asr, afilu shalob zman galus. A person is going to be experiencing simcha, which is not a simcha shel mitzvah. A person is going to be experiencing joy that has nothing to do with the celebration of a wedding, let's say, or sukkahs, or shavuos. Then, that type of simcha is asr, is forbidden, even when we're not in galus. L'malei pi'v schok. However, when a person has a joy which is connected to a mitzvah, commandments, like a wedding or Jewish holidays, then it would be permissible to have this kind of joy if the Beis Hamikdash was around. To go in Simchas Beis HaShoeva. It's the joy of on Sukkot when we bring forward the water libation. V'simchas David, Shayemech Karker, V'chol Oz. Or when David brought the Aron into the temple, and he was celebrating with all his might. Those things would be permissible to be fully bischok, fully joyous. V'zmana galus, irva kol simcha, v'afil b'simcha shal mitzvah, kagon b'chatuna o b'purim, b'komokom lo yimat b'lamalei pi v'schok, k'enir la'daniyas laiti nachon. However, in today's day and age, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, even a Simcha Shel Mitzvah, even at a time of a wedding or of Purim, it is appropriate to hold back. So this is an interesting idea where the Taz is now allied to these two values. There's the value generally of never being entirely joyous, which he says that value could have times where it applies, times where it does not apply, from not being completely joyous. There'd be a way out. But once the temple is destroyed, those loopholes, those ways out, those simcha shel mitzvahs, they no longer apply. They're closed off to us. So with this, we have completed our source sheet, and we've been able, hopefully, to establish that there is a value to our experience of this time period, the experience of Shivas Batamas, the Beinam Tzarim, and as well that there is a value within Judaism of generally being serious. Now imagine that there are probably some Hasidim in the room. Any Hasidim in the room? Now Hasidim will be quick to mention to me that everyone knows the famous song, Mitzvah Gedola Liot Besimcha. Liot Besimcha Tamid. Right? It is a commandment to be joyous. To be joyous always. Now, this is not a statement which has a long halachic pedigree, but it is a song that people like to sing. It comes from a Hasidic source. And it's also become a very popular part of our ethos in Judaism today. And I think it's not just the function of the general world which says you should never be sad. But our religious philosophy has been so informed by this idea that we generally really believe that a person should never be sad. It's religiously problematic to be sad. And this comes from a Hasidic idea of God's presence. That the Shekhinah, God, is with us specifically when we're able to experience a joyous moment. And that if we feel God and know God to be true and God to be good, how can we really be sad? So therefore, there is a connection in some way with this element of Hasidic thought that connects the value of joy with the experience of the divine. So therefore, it is a mitzvah gedola liot besimcha, tamid. It is a great mitzvah to always be joyous. Because to not experience that joy is to somehow push God from your soul. Now I'm going to tell you a little story about this Hasidic song. I am a student of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Yehuda Amital. They were the two Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Amital passed away 2 years ago now. And one Simchas Torah, we were dancing in the yeshiva. And the guys in the yeshiva started singing the song, Mitzvah Gedola Liot B'Simcha Tamir. There's a great command to be joyous always. And they were singing a couple of times. All of a sudden, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, should live and be well, stops the dancing. Says, stop the song. He says, you're singing the song wrong. It's not the way to sing the song. The Rosh Yeshiva knows the song better than we know to sing the song. What do you mean? He says that the philosophy of mitzvah gedola liot besimcha tamid is wrong. You shouldn't always be happy. There are times you're supposed to be sad. Tisha B'Av, you're supposed to be sad. So what does it mean? How should you sing the song? You should say, simcha gedola liot b'mitzvah. There is a great joy in being involved in a mitzvah. That's the message. Simcha gedola liot b'mitzvah. You want to really be joyous. Be engaged with God. Live the life of mitzvahs. That is true joy. Simcha gedola liot b'mitzvah. So being good students, we strike up the music. We sing the song, Simcha gedola liot b'mitzvah. And we sing and sing and sing. And then after a couple of rounds of the song, Rav Amital raises his hand and says, stop. What's wrong? Rav Amital says, no. The Hasidic value of mitzvah gedola yot besimcha is true. And how can we not imbue our lives with this value of joy? And so I always wonder whether they planned this out beforehand, the two of them. I'm convinced that they had this whole thing worked out beforehand. He said, what do we need to do this in class? We're going to work out some real good educational lesson for our students. So sure enough, we went back to the old way of singing it, and we sang Simcha Gedola Liot B'Mitzvah. What was that? Mitzvah Gadol Yat B'Simcha. Right, we went back to singing Mitzvah Gadol Yat B'Simcha. Thank you for that correction. But I believe within this machlokas, within this back and forth, is I think a great challenge of our day, Jewishly and also socially generally. Because we to be honest, you know, sadness is really not a good thing. Sadness hurts. It does hurt. And we want to, as best we can, live lives of happiness. But the world is also a very sad place. There are a lot of bad things that happen in it. And all too often, we can be blind to reality by what we hope should be. I'm not sure how many people have ever been to a shiva house and heard people say something stupid. But often people do say stupid things. One of those stupid things people say at shiva houses is, you should never have to sit shiva again. The implication of that, of course, being was what you mean, that I should die first before the rest of my relatives, so I'll never have to sit shiva again? Is that what you mean? People die. And when people die, it's sad. And at a shiva house, you should not be trying to make people happy. There are specific halachos which are meant to prevent you from doing that. The avos speaks first. We're not trying to distract from the reality of this world. And we become, in our pursuit of happiness, which is not the Hasidic happiness of God's presence, but is a happiness of shallow hope, of denial of the sad things in this world, we become shallow people. We become dishonest people. We don't really live the way that we should. And so, on this day of sadness, and this day of reflection, I think it's important to hear both Simcha Gadol Aliyot B'Mitzvah and Mitzvah Gadol Aliyot B'Simcha, to hear both those values, to try to live lives of happiness, of God's presence, of goodness, but also to know that the words of Kohelet also ring true. There has to be limits on our happiness. And there also, there is no problem in life being in moments where we are sad. I'm happy to take any questions you might have. Yes. So I just sort of to summarize the question, the element of balance is something you agree to, that there are times when we are to be sad. However, the description of the Shulchan Aruch's paradigm of a life without music, you might say, or a life without with on wedding days being breaking cups and being sad at those times, it's the balance might be a little bit off kilter, you might say, from what you're describing. And that it seems to have gone too far. That if we are to be sad, it can be a little bit sad. But to cut off a whole approach to life where joy is at the center, that might be too much. Okay, I mean, I think that's a fair comment. I would only say that there's the historical piece of really wanting Jerusalem back, and to the degree of how comfortable we become in our exile. And there's a piece of this which is also the moral point about sadness, but there's another piece of it as well, which is, are we really missing Jerusalem? Do we really miss the temple? And some of this is to ensure that we don't forget. And perhaps there are pieces which are meant to cramp our style. There's some parts of this which are really meant to get in the way. And by getting in the way, we really take to heart that whether it be 2,000 years or 2 years, that we're not where we should be. Other comments or questions? Yes, Ralph. Isn't the idea of being sad and serious all the time a real turnoff? I mean, I think there are different types of people out there. And I think that it's unfair for us to prejudice the human experience by those people who are enamored with the happy narrative. I think that there are all sorts of personalities, and that we shouldn't necessarily say that everyone is meant to experience a certain level of happiness. I think that for many people, the happiness narrative is a turnoff. That to live a fully balanced life with periods of happiness and periods of sadness, or for that matter, periods of seriousness, I think there's more to it. And I think that, I think you're right that in our society, you know, to be sad and serious is to be a loser. And I think that our society is worse off for it. I think that the well-examined life, a life of introspection, a life of emotional seriousness, where we experience the world and don't just pass off the bad things and let them go and pretend that they're not there. I think that's a life which is better lived. And I think our society is worse off for creating an ideal which really says that what you want from life is happiness. I think there's more to life than that. Yes. I'm not sure if everyone heard Jay, but Jay makes a very good point about how we teach Judaism and the degree to which we teach Judaism with a teleology, with an expectation that it's going to lead to an experience of happiness, which is, why should you live a Jewish lifestyle? Because Jews are happier than other people. Because if you really do it right, if you keep halacha right, it's going to make your life better. And that better is seen as being more happy. It's I think it's a fair point. It's a fair point that there is a degree in which we lose aspects of our Judaism in that. Yes. Yes. So this is all in a different point, but how do we actually get happiness? The idea of searching for happiness is a paradigm which, you know, is much, I think, affected by the U.S. Declaration of Independence, right? The pursuit of happiness, inalienable rights, the pursuit of happiness. And it's built upon a paradigm that happiness is somehow out there. And you have to go out and get it. And one of the, I think, the ironies of life is that the more that you expect from life, the more that you think you're going to deserve, or the more you expect from a human experience, that when you actually experience it, if it doesn't meet your expectations, how do you feel? You feel let down. You feel like it wasn't really worth it. Whereas if you have low expectations, and you're not really expecting so much from an experience, and then something exceeds your expectations, how do you feel? You feel very good, much happier. So I would be of the view that very often happiness is not something you have to go out and get. Happiness is something that if you think deeply about it, experience life in a full way, happiness is something you achieve inside. It's not something about going and doing, but something which is a element of shleimut, of completeness, in some way, which is not achieved simply by external experiences or external achievements. But again, I think you're right as far as the description about what people, what sort of how the software in our brains have been jigged up by the society in which we live. That I think that it is common to believe that happiness is something you go out and get. We have a statement in our tradition, Ezehu Ashir Asameach B'chelko. Who is the person who is wealthy is the person who is happy with his portion. And I think that comes from the same genre of approach towards life lessons or life values or happiness goals. That being Sameach B'chelko is not something about getting more. Sameach B'chelko is something that we decide we are going to be Sameach in that moment, in that thing. And I think that the sadness point which I was making here today is one layer, one balance with that element of simcha. Simcha is very much part of Judaism. Simcha is very important in all sorts of areas. But so too is this other element, the balance, the not going too far in our simcha, not believing that simcha is the end unto itself. That's also part of it. Okay, I think I'm just about over time now. So I think there's going to be a break, and then the next speaker will be starting in 5 minutes.